Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. From time to time, I am still stunned, staggered, wanting to scream by the utter depravity of the mobsters who command the national security apparatus of the so-called free world. Former President Bush has been taking a drubbing for a while for his religious hypocrisy. And it's true, no other torturer and mass murderer can thump a Bible louder than George. I don't get upset about his pious hypocrisy. My feeling is, once you've killed your first million people, why have them throw the book at you? Bush killed about 1.5 million people. Why add hypocrisy to your excuses for not inviting them over for Easter supper? Would you say about someone, "He killed 1 million people, and he continues to shoplift"? When it comes to total sociopathic depravity, though, it's hard to beat the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Directorate of Intelligence, White House, the whole national security state, so-called. Here's one more quick example. The Bay of Pigs invasion wasn't an attempt to overthrow Castro in Cuba. The CIA knew that didn't have a chance. The CIA and Pentagon bigwigs wanted an armed conflict between the U.S. and Cuba that would escalate into war with the Soviet Union. They tried to do it again in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. "Come on, Jack! Let's bomb them missile bases before the Ruskies have a chance to arm them with nuclear warheads! Do it now! Push the button, Jack!" Why did the entire national security state, except the president, want nuclear war with the Soviet Union? Because we would win! We have way more bombs and rockets than they do. Let's kill communism now while we've got an easy victory, before they catch up with us. Seriously, they calculated that at least 120 million Ruskies would die, and we'd lose only 40 million or so Americans. I can understand differences of opinion about 9/11, but one opinion just makes my hypothalamus explode when someone naively says, "Are you asking me to believe my government would kill or refuse to prevent the killing of 3,000 Americans? Oh, perish the thought. How about 4,200 American soldiers, supposedly to get revenge for those 3,000? How about 60,000 U.S. soldiers and 5 million Vietnamese in a war that Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon all knew was a crock of nitrogen-rich fertilizer? How about 40 million Americans to save the world from Soviet communism? All this is background to today's story, which is about the CIA's MK-Ultra program. This top-secret program apparently began in 1953, though its roots go back to our Take a Nazi Torturer to Lunch Week in 1947, otherwise known as Operation Paperclip. MK-Ultra was interested in making new discoveries about thought control, brainwashing, and sophisticated torture techniques. Take another look at those photos from Abu Ghraib, those reports from Guantanamo. There you have it. MK-Ultra, the gift that keeps on giving. People were killed or practically destroyed by the program. True, not on the scale of Vietnam or Iraq or even 9/11. How many deaths is too few to worry about? Some were killed, and Gail Kastner was nearly destroyed, by being used as guinea pigs in medical experiments without even their knowledge, let alone their informed consent. That's enough to get the researcher hanged at Nuremberg. Naomi Klein tells the story of Gail Kastner and the CIA-sponsored mind control experiments of MK-Ultra. Klein reads from her book, The Shock Doctrine.
Her back pain is just one reminder of the 63 times that 150 to 200 volts of electricity penetrated the frontal lobes of her brain, while her body convulsed violently on the table, causing fractures, sprains, bloody lips, broken teeth. Gail often leans over to write something on a scrap of paper or a cigarette box. "A note to myself," she explains, "or I will never remember." For her entire adult life, Gail's mind has failed her. Facts evaporate instantly. Memories, if they are there, and many aren't, are like snapshots scattered on the ground. And so she makes lists. At first she apologizes for the clutter, but later she says, "He did this to me. This apartment is part of the torture." For many years, Gail was quite mystified by her lack of memory, as well as other idiosyncrasies. She did not know, for instance, why a small electrical shock from a garage door opener set off an uncontrollable panic attack, or why her hands shook when she plugged in her hairdryer. Most of all, she could not understand why she could remember most events from her adult life, but almost nothing from before she turned 20. Gail figured it was all part of her shaky mental health. In her 20s and 30s, she had struggled with depression and addiction to pills, and would sometimes have such severe breakdowns that she would end up hospitalized and comatose. These episodes provoked her family to disown her, leaving her so alone and desperate that she survived by scavenging from the bins outside grocery stores. There had also been hints that something even more traumatic had happened early on. Before her family cut ties, Gail and her identical twin sister used to have arguments about a time when Gail had been much sicker and Zella had had to take care of her. "You have no idea what I went through," Zella would say. "You would urinate on the living room floor and suck your thumb and talk baby talk, and you would demand the bottle of my baby." But Gail had no memory of ever doing such strange things. In her late 40s, Gail began a relationship with a man named Jacob, whom she describes as her soulmate. Jacob was a Holocaust survivor, and he was also preoccupied with questions of memory and loss. For Jacob, who died more than a decade ago, Gail's unaccountably missing years were intensely troubling. "There has to be a reason," he would say about the gaps in her life. "There has to be a reason." In 1992, Gail and Jacob happened to pass by a newsstand with a large sensational headline, "Brainwashing Experiments, Victims to be Compensated." Kastner started skimming the article, and several phrases immediately leaped out. Baby talk, memory loss, incontinence. Sitting in a nearby coffee shop, the couple read an incredible story about how, in the 1950s, the United States Central Intelligence Agency had funded a Montreal doctor to perform bizarre experiments on his psychiatric patients, keeping them asleep and in isolation for weeks, then administering huge doses of electroshock as well as experimental drug cocktails. The experiments, which reduced patients to pre-verbal infantile states, had been performed at McGill University's Allen Memorial Institute under the supervision of its director, Dr. Ewan Cameron. The CIA's funding of Cameron had been revealed in the late 70s through a Freedom of Information Act request, sparking hearings in the U.S. Senate. 9 of Cameron's former patients got together and sued the CIA as well as the Canadian government, which had also funded Cameron's research. Over protracted trials, the patients' lawyers argued that the experiments had violated all standards of medical ethics. They had gone to Cameron seeking relief from minor psychiatric ailments, postpartum depression, anxiety, even for help to deal with marital difficulties, and had been used, without their knowledge or permission, as human guinea pigs to satisfy the CIA's thirst for information about how to control the human mind. In 1988, the CIA settled, awarding a total of $750,000 in damages to the 9 plaintiffs. 4 years later, the Canadian government would agree to pay $100,000 in compensation to each patient who was part of the experiments. Like the free market economists, who are convinced that only a large-scale disaster, a great unmaking, can prepare the ground for their reforms, Cameron believed that by inflicting an array of shocks to the human brain, he could unmake and erase faulty minds, then rebuild new personalities on that ever-elusive, clean slate. "I realized then that these people must have gone through the same thing I went through. I said, 'Jacob, this has got to be the reason.'" Kastner wrote to the Allen and requested her medical file. At first, being told that they had no record of her, she finally got it. All 138 pages. The doctor who had admitted her was Ewan Cameron. The letters, notes, and charts in Gail's medical file tell a heartbreaking story. One as much about the limited choices available to an 18-year-old girl in the 50s, as about governments and doctors abusing their power. The file begins with Dr. Cameron's assessment of Gail on her admittance. She is a McGill nursing student, excelling in her studies, whom Cameron describes as a hitherto reasonably well-balanced individual. She is, however, suffering from anxiety, caused, Cameron plainly notes, by her abusive father, an intensely disturbing man who made repeated psychological assaults on his daughter. In their early notes, the nurses seem to like Gail. She bonds with them about nursing, and they describe her as cheerful, sociable, and neat. But over the months she spent in and out of their care, Gail underwent a radical personality transformation. After a few weeks, she showed childish behavior, expressed bizarre ideas, and apparently was hallucinated and destructive. The notes report that this intelligent young woman could now manage to count only to 6. Next, she is manipulative, hostile, and very aggressive. Then passive and listless, unable to recognize her family members. Her final diagnosis is schizophrenic with marked hysterical features, far more serious than the anxiety she displayed when she arrived. The metamorphosis no doubt had something to do with the treatments that are also all listed in Kastner's chart. Huge doses of insulin, inducing multiple comas, strange combinations of uppers and downers, long periods when she was kept in a drug-induced sleep, and 8 times as many electroshocks as was standard at the time. Ewan Cameron, a Scottish-born American citizen, had reached the very pinnacle of his profession. He had been president of the American Psychiatric Association, president of the Canadian Psychiatric Association, and president of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, he was one of only 3 American psychiatrists asked to testify to the sanity of Rudolf Hess at the war crimes trials in Nuremberg. By the time Gail began her investigation, Cameron was long dead, but he had left dozens of academic papers and published lectures behind. Several books had also been published about the CIA's funding of mind control experiments, works that included plenty of detail about Cameron's relationship to the agency. According to his published papers from the time, he believed that the only way to teach his patients healthy new behaviors was to get inside their minds and break up old pathological patterns. The first step was de-patterning, which had a stunning goal: to return the mind to a state when it was, as Aristotle claimed, a writing tablet on which as yet nothing actually stands written, a tabula rasa. Cameron believed he could reach that state by attacking the brain with everything known to interfere with its normal functioning, all at once. It was shock and awe warfare on the mind. In dozens of clinical studies, doctors noted that in the immediate aftermath of treatment, patients sucked their thumbs, curled up in the fetal position, needed to be spoon-fed, and cried for their mothers. These behaviors usually passed quickly, but in some cases, when large doses of shock were used, doctors reported that their patients had regressed completely, forgetting how to walk and talk. To de-pattern his patients, Cameron used a relatively new device called the Page-Russell, which administered up to 6 consecutive jolts instead of a single one. Frustrated that his patients still seemed to be clinging to remnants of their personalities, he further disoriented them with uppers, downers, and hallucinogens. Once complete depatterning had been achieved, and the earlier personality had been satisfactorily wiped out, the psychic driving could begin. It consisted of Cameron playing his patients tape-recorded messages such as, "You are a good mother and wife, and people enjoy your company." As a behaviorist, he believed that if he could get his patients to absorb the messages on the tape, they would start behaving differently. With patients shocked and drugged into an almost vegetative state, they could do nothing but listen to the messages. For 16 to 20 hours a day, for weeks. In the mid-50s, several researchers at the CIA became interested in Cameron's methods. It was the start of the Cold War hysteria, and the agency had just launched a covert program devoted to researching what it called special interrogation techniques. A declassified CIA memorandum explained that the program examined and investigated numerous unusual techniques of interrogation, including psychological harassment and such matters as total isolation, as well as the use of drugs and chemicals. First codenamed Project Bluebird, then Project Artichoke, it was finally renamed MK-Ultra in 1953. Over the next decade, MK-Ultra would spend $25 million on research in a quest to find new ways to break prisoners suspected of being communists and double agents. 80 institutions were involved in the program, including 44 universities and 12 hospitals. The agents involved had no shortage of creative ideas for how to extract information from people who would rather not share it. The problem was finding ways to test those ideas.
Conquistador of Mexico, the Zulu and the Navajo, the Belgians in the Congo, short memory. Plantation in Virginia, the Raj in British India, the deadline in South Africa, short memory. The story of El Salvador, the silence of Hiroshima, destruction of Cambodia, short memory. Hilton style, with running water specially bought, short memory. A smallish man, Afghanistan, a watchdog in a nervous land, they're only there to lend a hand, short memory. The friendly five, a dusty smile, wake up in sweat at dead of night. Shot memory.
If word got out that the CIA was testing dangerous drugs on American soil, the entire program could be shut down, which is where the CIA's interest in Canadian researchers came in. The relationship dates back to June 1, 1951, and a tri-national meeting of intelligence agencies and academics at Montreal's Ritz-Carlton Hotel. The subject of the meeting was growing concern in the Western intelligence community that the communists had somehow discovered how to brainwash prisoners of war. The evidence was the fact that American GIs taken captive in Korea were going before cameras, seemingly willingly, and denouncing capitalism and imperialism. One of those at the Ritz meeting was Dr. Donald Hebb, director of psychology at McGill University. According to the declassified minutes, Hebb, trying to unlock the mystery of the GI confessions, speculated that the communists might be manipulating prisoners by placing them in intensive isolation and blocking input to their senses. The intelligence chiefs were impressed, and 3 months later, Hebb had a research grant from Canada's Department of National Defense to conduct a series of classified sensory deprivation experiments. Hebb paid a group of 63 McGill students $20 a day to be isolated in a room wearing dark goggles, headphones playing white noise, and cardboard tubes covering their arms and hands so as to interfere with their sense of touch. To see whether this deprivation made them more susceptible to brainwashing, Hebb then began playing recordings of voices talking about the existence of ghosts or the dishonesty of science, ideas the students had said they found objectionable before the experiment began. In a confidential report on Hebb's findings, the Defense Research Board concluded that sensory deprivation clearly caused extreme confusion as well as hallucinations among the student test subjects, and that a significant temporary lowering of intellectual efficiency occurred during and immediately after the period of perceptual deprivation. Furthermore, the students' hunger for stimulation made them surprisingly receptive to the ideas expressed on the tapes, and indeed several developed an interest in the occult that lasted weeks after the experiment had come to an end. A copy of Hebb's major study was sent to the CIA, as well as 41 copies to the U.S. Navy and 42 copies to the U.S. Army. Hebb's report noted that four of the subjects remarked spontaneously that being in the apparatus was a form of torture, which meant that forcing them to stay past their threshold, 2 or 3 days, would clearly violate medical ethics. Aware of the limitations this placed on the experiment, Hebb wrote that more clear-cut results were not available because it is not possible to force subjects to spend 30 to 60 days in conditions of perceptual isolation. Not possible for Hebb, but it was perfectly possible for his McGill colleague and academic arch-rival, Dr. Ewan Cameron. As for consent, his patients were at his mercy. The standard consent form endowed Cameron with absolute power to treat, up to, and including performing full frontal lobotomies. As the CIA dollars poured in, the Allen Memorial Institute seemed less like a hospital and more like a macabre prison. But where Hebb students fled less intense sensory deprivation after only a couple of days, Cameron kept his patients in for weeks, with one of them trapped in the isolation box for 35 days. Cameron's work was funded by the CIA until 1961, and for many years it wasn't clear what, if anything, the U.S. government did with his research. In the late 70s and 80s, when proof of the CIA's funding for the experiments finally came out in Senate hearings, journalists and legislators tended to accept the CIA's version of events. That it was conducting research into brainwashing techniques in order to protect captured U.S. soldiers. Most of the press attention focused on the sensational detail that the government had been funding acid trips. In fact, a large part of the scandal, when it finally broke, was that the CIA and Ewan Cameron had recklessly shattered lives with their experiments for no good reason. Everyone knew by then that brainwashing was a Cold War myth. When John Gittinger, the CIA psychologist who first reached out to Cameron, was forced to testify before a joint Senate hearing, he called the support for Cameron a foolish mistake, a terrible mistake. In 1988, the New York Times ran a groundbreaking investigation into U.S. involvement in torture and assassinations in Honduras. Florencio Caballero, an interrogator with Honduras's notoriously brutal Battalion 316, told the Times that he and 24 of his colleagues were taken to Texas and trained by the CIA. "They taught us psychological methods, to study the fears and weaknesses of a prisoner. Make him stand up, don't let him sleep, keep him naked and isolated, put rats and cockroaches in his cell, give him bad food, serve him dead animals, throw cold water on him, change the temperature." There was one technique he failed to mention: electroshock. Inez Murillo, a 24-year-old prisoner who was interrogated by Caballero and his colleagues, told the Times that she was electrocuted so many times that she screamed and fell down from the shock. "The screams just escape you," she said. "I smelled smoke and realized I was burning from the singes of the shocks. They said they would torture me until I went mad. I didn't believe them. But then they spread my legs and stuck the wires on my genitals. Murillo also said that there was someone else in the room, an American passing questions to her interrogators, whom the others called Mr. Mike. The revelations led to hearings of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, where the CIA's deputy director, Richard Stoltz, confirmed that Caballero did indeed attend a CIA human resources exploitation or interrogation course. Finally, under threat of a lawsuit, and 9 years after the original story was published, the CIA produced a handbook called Kubark Counterintelligence Interrogation. The handbook is a 128-page secret manual on the interrogation of resistant sources that is heavily based on the research commissioned by MKUltra. And Ewan Cameron's and Donald Hebb's experiments have left their marks all over it. Methods range from sensory deprivation to stress positions, from hooding to pain. It represents a new age of precise, refined torture, not the gory, inexact torment that had been the standard since the Spanish Inquisition. In a kind of preface, the manual states, "The intelligence service, which is able to bring pertinent modern knowledge to bear upon its problems, enjoys huge advantages over a service which conducts its clandestine business in 18th century fashion." What follows is a how-to guide on dismantling personalities. The manual describes several of the techniques that were honed to depattern patients in the basement of the Allen Memorial Institute. What most captured the imagination of Kubark's authors more than any individual technique was Cameron's focus on regression. The idea that by depriving people of their sense of who they are and where they are in time and space, adults can be converted into dependent children whose minds are a blank slate of suggestibility. Prisoners are captured in the most jarring and disorienting way possible, late at night or in early morning raids, as the manual instructs. They are immediately hooded or blindfolded, stripped and beaten, then subjected to some form of sensory deprivation. And from Guatemala to Honduras, Vietnam to Iran, the Philippines to Chile, the use of electroshock is ubiquitous. In 1966, the CIA sent three psychiatrists to Saigon, armed with a Page Russell, the same kind of electroshock machine favored by Cameron. It was used so aggressively that it killed several prisoners. For U.S. intelligence officials, that kind of hands-on approach was rare. From the 70s on, the role favored by American agents was that of mentor or trainer, not direct interrogator. Testimony from Central American torture survivors in the 70s and 80s is littered with references to mysterious English-speaking men walking in and out of cells proposing questions or offering tips. Though sanctioned by successive administrations in Washington, the U.S. role in these dirty wars had to be covert, for obvious reasons. Simply put, what they were teaching was illegal. If anyone asked, U.S. agents were tutoring their developing world students in modern professional policing methods. On September 11, 2001, that long-time insistence on plausible deniability went out the window. The terrorist attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon was a different kind of shock from the ones imagined in the pages of the Kubark manual, but its effects were remarkably similar. Profound disorientation, extreme fear and anxiety, and collective regression.
Naomi Klein reading from The Shock Doctrine. Thanks to Unwelcome Guests Collective for the full recording. This show comes to you from WWUH, broadcasting from the University of Hartford. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again.